I'm Frank Gallagher, host of Soundman Confidential. It's showtime. Plug in. I'm kicking off Soundman Confidential with a Scotsman like myself. Jim Kerr is the lead singer of Simple Minds. I was the band's live soundman in the early 1980s. They'd come from playing smaller venues in Glasgow, Jim's hometown, and were only a few years away from hitting the big time with hits like Alive and Kicking and Promised You a Mackerel. I've remained good pals with Jim and the band's co-founder, Charlie Burchell, who will be a future guest on the show. But for now, break out the shortbread, sit back, and enjoy my chat with Jim Kerr on episode 1 of Soundman Confidential. I'll catch up with you at the end of the show. Give us a wee 1-2 for the sound check.
1-2, buckle my fucking shoe.
Wire in, son. You got it in one. You've got the job. You sound great. You sound great. Well, this is the format of this, the subject matter of this wee podcast, Jim, is discussing the relationship between the sound man and the band, and that connection that meets in the middle with the audience. And I don't think it's a subject that's been addressed, and it won't be a technical issue. It'll be more of an esoteric and more of a vibe issue. This discussion, and so you and I go back a few years. In the interest of full disclosure, I did a few tours with Simple Minds mixing the front of house for them back in the early days.
Well, Frank, first of all, thanks for having me in your podcast, and I wish you all the best with it. I think it's a great thing you're doing. I just listen to podcasts day in and day out, and I don't know any other that's trying to get to the place that you're looking to get to, so I hope I can help with that today. But I was thinking this afternoon where I first met you, and we'd heard about you before we met you. I think most people would, probably most people would have the same thought, because you had you were larger for a wee guy, Frank, and we're all wee. I hope that phone in the background, it'll go off in a minute. It isn't putting you off, is it?
No bother.
Okay, so I'll pick it up. For a wee guy, and most of the people that come from the area that you and I come from are wee guys, you had a big rep and a very good reputation as well. I mean, our manager at the time, Bruce Finlay, and our mentor, I mean, Simple Minds were very lucky. In the early days, we came across two or three people who I would put down as being great mentors to the band, great coaches, even in a sense. You don't really hear the word coach attached to rock bands, but we'll probably get to that later and why I think it's applicable. But you were definitely a mentor, but our first mentor was Bruce Finlay, who came from Falkirk, which is not far from the area you were brought up in, and Banknock in Glasgow. And the thing about Bruce was that he was, there was about five or six really cool record shops in Scotland at the time. They were all independents then. And Bruce's family owned them. And we all grew up getting into Bruce's and stuff. And Bruce used to tell us, oh, there's this guy, Frank Gallagher. He's a sound guy, and he's in New York, and he was in, and blah, blah, blah. So, Bruce had told us about you, but the big news was when we started hearing about Frank's working with Talking Heads. Now, this would be, we first heard about that in 79, and I think from the last years of the 70s right through to the mid-80s, Talking Heads were arguably the coolest band on the planet. And for us to know that a Scottish guy was doing the sound for them, because there wasn't really a lot of Scots in the industry then. And if somebody was doing good, you were proud. And the fact that Talking Heads, which, they were just they were everybody's favourite band, and the fact that Frank's doing a sound for them, well, that was a big deal. But getting to the original point, I first met you when Simple Minds played in, it's a club in Paris, a very hip club that, let's call it the new wave bands were playing, because in 1979 punk was over, called Le Bandouche. And Simple Minds, I think we played, either we played two nights or we played a matinee and a gig. And this guy, Frank, who we'd all heard about, came down and you came back, and it was you know, we were all chuffed to meet you, and you were great. You were you know, really supportive on that night, and we could see that, you know, we were of the same ilk and the same neck of the woods, supported the same football team. And and I think that's my earliest. I remember, I think it was between sets, because we never spoke to you long, but we were all having a chat with you, and Charlie, you were making us laugh, as you always did, and you still do. And well, basically, that's my earliest memory.
Hi, I remember that Bandouche gig. I think I was in Paris with Talking Heads or somebody, and I had a break between soundcheck and show, I think, and I came down to see you guys early.
Yeah.
And hang out and have a wee puff. And
that. Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And that, as we did back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, and getting back to the early days, we sat in vans where knees at our chin back then, you know what I mean? It was, we weren't in it for the comfort.
Well, you know what? That's absolutely true. Anybody thinking, you know, rock and roll was a glamorous lifestyle, which, you know, when you read about it in the newspapers and all that, it seemed that way. But the reality of, I remember when we got a record deal, Simple Minds got a record deal. We got it pretty fast, to be honest with you. We formed in November 1978 was the first time. Sorry, November 1977 was the first time we went in a rehearsal room. And exactly a year later, I was in London and they were discussing the sort of, you know, sort of crossing the T's and dotting the I's on a worldwide record deal, which was, you know, within a year. That was something. But I remember when we signed the record deal, of course we got an advance. It meant we had a wage, and it meant we could buy the necessary equipment, and it meant that we could buy a van, as you said, so, which was a brand new van. We could go on tour and all that. But I remember it sort of dawning on me, okay, you've signed the record deal, which you got to remember, Frank, we'd never met anyone that had signed a record deal. I mean, until we had, it wasn't as if, it's different now where then to sign a record deal, the idea that a major record company was going to sign you a worldwide record deal and put your album in the shop window and all that stuff, coming from where we came from, you had as much chance, this is without exaggeration, you had as much chance of being an astronaut. Uh-huh. And because it just didn't happen. We didn't know anyone. We'd never met anyone that had written songs until we wrote songs, because there was guys in bands, but, you know, they played Eagles covers, or they played Wishbone Ash covers, or they played whatever was being played then. So the idea that this could be done was mind-blowing. But getting to the real point, as soon as we signed the record deal, you thought, well, we're there, aren't we? No, you're no there. First of all, how are you going to learn to be a great band? How are you going to learn to write great songs? How are you going to... I mean, obviously, we were signed on potential and vibe, and we had written some songs, and they came up to see us, and we've been going down well. We're taking the baby steps, and the baby steps are obviously exciting enough for Clive Davis's record label to take a shot on us. So there was... I think it's a bit like when you see an athlete, you can tell early they've got the goods, but but, you know, there's a lot between talent, there's an awful lot of wasted talent. And at the end of the day, if it was a toss up between desire and talent. I think desire's the thing that really gets you there. There's nothing more common than wasted talent, to be honest with you. However, getting to your point, the desire comes when, hey, are you going to go in this van, as you say, with your knees up to your chin and drive from here to Lisbon to do a gig to a half-empty hall and then drive all the way back? And, you know, you've got years of that. And going fast forward, I think outside of, even more than actually being at the board and doing the sound for us, which was the greatest thing, I think having you around for us in that period when we needed to find out if we were going to fight for it, because nothing was coming easy. We weren't selling records. We weren't in the charts. We certainly weren't making money. There was no consistency. We'd play one night in Germany and it'd be fantastic, and you think, oh, we're on our way, and then you drive the next night to Hanover and there's three people there you know, and you plummet. So we needed somebody. We had good managers in the office and in the record company, but we needed, at a certain point, we needed somebody with us out on the road who was going to put the fight in us, and that's where you were especially great for our band.
It was a great time, and I was just talking to Bruce as well about how he made the call to me, and it was funny because there was no cell phones, and I was living in New York up on 85th and Columbus, The phone rang and I happened to be there because Talking Heads were off the road, and he shut that door. He asked me if I would be interested in mixing. I think you were coming to America and then Canada.
Yes.
As well.
Yes.
And so that translated into me actually coming across the pond as well and cutting a deal with Bruce.
Yeah, well, as I said, I remember going on that tour. And when I say, just to sort of let people know the thing, because, you know, we were playing clubs. The odd university or something. But in those days, you know, we didn't really carry equipment, so you had to deal with the promoter, and they would, whatever was there. Well, they would promise to provide it all, but rarely was that the case. You would turn up and there would be, you know, half the things would be missing, or they would be broken or whatever. In fact, going back to that thing about putting the fight in his, I remember one night, I don't remember what, it might have been Edmonton or something.
Oh.
And we did the sound check, and, you know, you were happy enough. That we're, as usual, we were late and the doors were opening, and there were people actually coming. What had gone out in Canada about us? But we'd done the sound check, and the monitors were just terrible. The speakers were blown, and I plummeted. You know, I was standing, and you come up and you said, you know, you looked at my demeanor, and you said, well, you know, what's the matter? And I had a right good old moan, you know, telling you on this and that and da da da. And you were, you were looking at me and you were listening and da da da. But it ended. You went, and what are you going to do? You're going to go home and cry at your mammy? Or are you going to go up and play? You know, we're here. You need to lift yourself. You need to win it. And I remember, and I think we something said, like, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen are playing here next week. You want to make sure people coming here the night think you're much better than them. It was that kind of a thing. And that's what I mean about coaching. You know, that a sort of athletic coach would talk to you like that. It was like, you know, get on with it. And we still have that in us. You know, we fight for it every night wherever we are. You know, all these years later, decades later, you get out to play a festival. The minute you walk on stage, the clouds, you know, open. What are you going to do? Are you going to cry for your mommy? Or are you going to ignore it and just get into the heart of the show? And we learned, you gave us that attitude.
Well, I got that growing up too, because you know I'm from a wee village, and there wasn't that much work there. You had to fight for whatever you could get, and I've never lost that. And it's not even a case of fighting; it's just no letting them take the ball off you.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think
you can't let them take the ball off you. That's my benchmark.
Well, if you'd said to me when I was a kid, you know, all these years later, here's the good news. All these years later, you're going to have a record deal and you're going to be in the middle of Canada and you're going to have this band with all your pals and you're going to be up there and people are going to like your music and they're going to be coming to see you. That's the good news. Here's the bad news. You're staying in a dump. You've no money. No enough people have really heard about you. The equipment is crap. You're going to feel humiliated some nights. You're going to feel the depression. The doubts are going to overtake you. You're going to have stage fright. Here's the question. If you say to me, that's the good news, that's the deal, that's the good and the bad. Do you want it or do you not want it? I would have bitten the hand off you. I want it.
Aye.
And we had to remember that.
Aye, because... It's not even just the Scottishness that's in us. It's the Celtic side of the Scottish nature that's in us as well. There's a big difference. And somebody pointed that out to me without me even thinking about it. Because I've got a lot of, my dad was Irish, and there's a lot of Irish connections between us as well. And I think there's a grain of truth there that the Celtic Scots, the Irish Scots, were think differently and fight differently.
Well, I think that tribe thing, certainly yes. In our case, everything you said there adds up. But in case of Charlie and I, and we could even bring that to a more micro, we're from the same street. We're from the same gang. And so our band was our gang. And, you know, you kind of have your gang getting beat. You know, you have to, when you go on stage, I mean, the stage to me is, you know, it's a mystical place, the stage, no matter who it is, if it's a, you know, comedian going up to an open mic or something, when you go up there, you know, you're saying, look at me, I'm special. I've got something special. Because if it's just a thing, no, I just want to play music, I'm just there because I do my thing. No, you don't. You can do that in the garage.
Exactly.
You can do that. If you're going on stage, you're saying, hey, check this out. You'll like this. This is good. And so, but that, saying that is one thing. Delivering on it and delivering on it every night is something else. And you have to find something in you that at a certain point, you know, blinkers you so that anything that could get in the way. Because, you know, we see a lot of people have seen a good band, you go to see them one night, great, you see them a week later, they're not into it. Even though they're great singers or they're great players, I don't know, they're just, when people say to me, you know, quite a lot, you know, talking, I'll say, they say, how did you do this and how did you do that? And I always start by saying, well, I was really lucky. And then they'll go, and oh, come on, it's no luck. You've worked hard and you've done this. I say, no, it's luck. And I tell you why, because just as you are, I came to the opinion that you have to be born to this in a way to really do it, I think you have to be a type to really do it, to make it the most important thing in your life. As a lot of people get the chance and they go out and they don't like touring, or they don't like being away from home, or they don't like... the commitment, or they don't like this, or they don't like that. And I was thinking, how could you not like this? I mean, this is the greatest thing, it, when you play and people love it and all that. But then I just came to accept some people quit after 5 years, some people quit after 10 years. I think, how could you quit this? But aye. I've come to the opinion that people are different. And going back to being lucky, I think people like us that have managed to do it and managed to do it all our lives, it's because somewhere we were of a type. And that when it comes down to it, that it's fundamental.
Aye. I remember the throbbing of the generators in the base of the shows, the travelling fairground that would come to Banknock and park up. And I could smell the I was 3 years old, and I remember hearing bass for the first time. I probably heard bass in utero, you know, or when I was 2 year old. I remember this, at least when I was three, I remember hearing the generators and the smell of diesel and the big speakers that they had, because they had to get the speakers on the waltzer and all and other music, because that's how they attracted people.
It sounded great. It always sounded
and it
great.
Sounded the fairground. So it's funny. There's a lot of people say that's where they first came in, because I'd never heard loud music before.
I like the idea of you saying that, Frank, because, you know, it's timely. Obviously, a few weeks ago, a month ago, Little Richard died. I mean, you think, I was listening to him and, you know, his whole shtick, because Little Richard's the original, but his whole shtick, he said, his look, he got that from the kind of travelling freak shows that, well, they weren't even allowed in town. They were on the outskirts of town. He would go out and he would see, he would hear the sounds, and he would see, you know, people dressed in the most outlandish, freakish way. But getting back to the sound, as you said, that would somehow plant a seed in you. That's interesting.
Oh, it dragged me in. It dragged me in.
Yeah.
And we didn't have a television growing up. My dad would listen to the wireless, you know, and he'd listen to the BBC, and he'd listen to Radio Erin as well, the Irish station, and that would just come in and out. And so I think I got dragged into it. But I think I was born with this. I think I was a gypsy in a past life. And I said to my daughter, when she was like three, I said, Leah, have you been here before? She said, oh, yes, Daddy, I've been here before.
Amazing.
So... amazing. A three-year-old would tell you that. So coming for that village life and getting out, you know, and it's funny, I got in touch with a guy on Facebook for the village. I haven't heard from him in 50 years. And he said, you were the first guy to get out of the village with this wee band, The Casuals, who had a hit in 1968. And I wasn't even a roadie. I just piled into the van and wouldn't get out. You know, where he's gone. They were English as well. Where he's gone. And so I ended up just being a moocher and getting into that.
Well, we have something in common with you there as well, and I guess something that defines. I mean, there are people, again, get back to this thing of how we would differentiate ourselves. You know, especially back then, just to put it in perspective, because everybody knows, if you're talking about the 70s, the early 70s, maybe even late 60s in your case, Frank.
Aye.
You know, there wasn't cheap travel and to go abroad and to do those things, well, abroad from the UK, hasn't gone to European continent or gone to London, you had to make a serious effort and a serious commitment. And a bit like yourselves, I mean, for people who don't know, Charlie Birch and I grew up in the same street, we went to the same school, and essentially Simple Minds grew out of a school band, really. We were a group of friends that everyone was starting to get into music, but we were so into it that we were only content just to listen to records. The guys ended up getting instruments and then, you know, starting to get a, you could call it a garage band or whatever. But the other thing we had in common, or the thing that defined us, was this urge to get out and see what else was going on beyond the city walls, really. And we had this thing. There was a period. There was, well, 1976, there was a fella on our street. He was a couple of years older, and he moved to London. He had he was the brightest guy in school. He could pass any exam without even studying. He just had it. And yet he wasn't interested in any academic kind of thing. Unlike in the States, where, you know, people would go to colleges and universities and all that. I was just reading the other day, check this, that in the period we grew up in Glasgow, less than 1% of kids whose parents were manual workers went to university. and our parents were manual workers. So, you know, university. Exactly. So university, college, you know, higher education were bright enough, but it just didn't interest us. However, my friend had gone to London, and how quaint is this? He sent me this letter. I remember getting it. And I'd seen the name pop up a couple of times in the music papers, but he said, "You've got to come down. There's this great thing happening here. It's called the Sex Pistols." and they play in this pub across the road from me in Tufnell Park. And they play every Sunday. You got to come down and see it. Punk rock. It's the new. We already knew the New York punk scene, and we knew that, you know, the Ramones and the Dolls and the Velvet and Lou Reed, of course, earlier and all that. Patti Smith's album. So this punk thing we heard about, but the idea that there was a London punk scene, he said, "So you got to come down." So Charlie and I, we'd got a job working on a building site for a few weeks, just labouring, and God knows how we could labour. I mean, I don't know. Him and I were like
a bit like me,
skinny little elves. But anyway, we saved up a few pounds, and we hitchhiked down to London with the intention of going to stay with me. We're going to see the Sex Pistols playing on a Sunday. So this was a Friday, and we hitchhiked down. We couldn't believe how well the lifts went. I mean, you don't see people hitchhiking anymore. No one needs to. You can get a flight for like $10. But we're hitchhiking down, and on the last lift, truck driver says to us, "So, you know, what are you doing and that?" And we told him. And we said, "How about you?" And he said, "Oh, well, I'm going to stay in London tomorrow night, and then I'm going to Paris on Sunday." And we went, "Paris?" And he went, "Aye, Paris, I'll take you to Paris." He wanted to go to Paris. And in those days, you could get a passport from the post office. You could get a sort of temporary passport. So we went, Sex Pistols or Paris? And we thought, let's go to Paris. And we ended up, from there, we ended up going all the way around Europe. And, of course, we hadn't started the band or anything yet, but it opened our eyes to lots of stuff. It gave us this feeling of, oh, there's a world out there. And by that time, we had dreams about being in a band. But by that, after seeing that, we thought, not only do we want to be in a band, and we want to be in a great band, but we want to be in a band that can play all over the world, because there's a world out there. So I guess, you know, like you, we had that wanderlust in us, which is a big part of what we do as well, because you're either a traveller or you're not.
Aye, without question. We're not tourists, we're travellers. But I knew when I was young that I was going to get out of the village. So I got into the hotel business. So I would go and work summer seasons and then come back to the village and do a bit of labour. But I was, like you, I wasn't built for that. I wasn't built for building sites. I think a week and a half was as long as I lasted.
Well, I just think you had this deeper sense. People like we had a deeper sense of there's other stuff out there. And I want to know what it is, and I want to touch it, and I want to see it. It wasn't. I mean, some people see us, you know. Because the Glasgow we grew up in, Glasgow's got a great reputation now. You know, people, "Oh, I'm going to Glasgow," and they like it, and it's this. But when we grew up in Glasgow, it was on its knees. It was
rough.
At the end of the industrial age. And I didn't know I was born in a slum. I read it recently. But, you know, the industrial age had passed, the city was on its knees, everything seemed monochrome. And we didn't know anything other than monochrome. But and it was fine, we liked it enough, we loved it enough, but it was like you just had this sense of other stuff out there. And that became an engine as well.
Aye. Well, I took French instead of woodwork. I had a choice to take tech or French, and I took French, and then I ended up doing cooking. And another thing that drove me to get out of the village too was to taste stuff. and get food and get, and so I've always loved that aspect of traveling. You know, a lot of guys will go, but it's no egg and chips. Well, you're right, it's no, because you're in Paris or you're in Rome, you know, or you're in Tokyo.
Yeah.
But I had a guy in Tokyo complain to me that the McDonald's wasn't right. I said, go to your room. Just go, don't talk to me.
Well, there is. Like, if you have that, sometimes you go on tour and some of the guys, you know, I mean, think when we're there and you've got the chance to, if you get a day off or whatever, you get a chance to go to whatever, a museum or the things that people would dream of. And yet, you know, some of the people we work with, they just stay in the room or they don't want to know or they don't want to make the effort. Again, just back to that thing, people are different, but certainly to be an artist and you have that in you as well, it's not that you need to be, you're a sponge. And you take things in aware, even unaware. And you take things and going back into what I was saying earlier about us being younger and having the benefit of mentors like yourself, like Bruce, that had been travelled and done it, you know, to turn up in a place where you and you would know, it seems a wee thing, but it's a big thing. You would know, certainly a big thing. People make fortunes writing travel books. Where, you know, you would say, this is the best cafe down here. You got to try this cappuccino or come here. This has got the best toasted sandwich. It was the idea of somebody showing you the ropes, it was a big deal. And because the other thing we haven't said too, I mean, I did at the start, I went into saying how it was tough and all that, but we all, the other side of that, the balance meant that it had to be great fun because.
Oh, it was. It was brilliant.
If it wasn't great fun, you would go home when it was relentlessly tough. But so it had to be great fun as well. It had to be, and I was talking about that earlier. I mean, somebody who you know as well, our bass player at the time, Derek Forbes. Apart from Derek's, you know, apart from everything he brought to the band, and apart from his contribution, he was a great comedian, Derek.
Oh, he was. And still his snores. I think it's his nose that does it.
Well, it was great. Beak. But that there was a real importance to that role because you needed somebody when it was, you know, when the chips were a bit down and all that, you needed somebody to lighten it, and you needed somebody to create the atmosphere, and you think, oh, well, you know, tomorrow's another day. We live to fight another day. But, you know, I value all that stuff now because it had to be fun, and it was the greatest fun. I mean, I was talking to my younger brother, Mark, the other day, and he also toured with you in the early days, and he was saying, oh, Frank, it was just great, great fun. It was so important to have that as well as the seriousness of making the impact, because you only get one shot in a town
exactly.
that night. We knew what was at stake. If people came and they liked it, not only was it great because they'd enjoyed themselves, but it meant the best promo was them going to work or going to college the next day and saying to people, you missed yourself. You have to go the next time.
Or else. No internet.
Or else, ultimately, I went there last night, it sucked. And you knew what side. Well, you knew what was at stake. That was huge. So, but it needed to be fun, and you know, we had great fun.
You know, it's funny. People said to me, "Well, how did you get into this?" I say, "Well, I didn't fucking fill out an application form. I mean,
no.
I wasn't interviewed for any job I've ever got." Well, people would phone me up and say, "Are you free?" And I mean, I've been sacked. I've been asked not to come back. I've walked away from stuff in those early days. But that was me. I've always. But at the end of the day, when I'm sitting out there mixing, I'm among them. I'm out there among them. And I can tell if they're getting it.
Well, one of the great things fairly recently, and you'll remember this, was that 2 years ago when we were on tour and Simple Minds were on tour with B-52s, which was just great because, you know, we hooked up again and you were, well, you still are, but you were doing sounds for them. And it was great. You and I had breakfast first thing in the hotel that morning, see you down at the gig and all that. And then, you know, I was curious. It was a long time since I'd seen you go to work. And it sounded fantastic. The band really sounded fantastic. And the thing is, well, especially Charlie, but me too, there's nothing worse. You go to see a band you like and it doesn't sound very good. I mean, we can go into that now. I mean, there's a fairly newish venue in Glasgow. It's been there about 10 years now, but the Hydro. Right. And the whole sort of spiel before it opened was it was built for sound and it was, you know, it was unlike other venues. It is not rubbish. It's just a big dome.
Aye.
And anyway, I've been in there I've seen some gigs where it's just a travesty. I mean, it's just a travesty, just the sound. I mean, the last three times I saw Prince play, everybody goes, oh, Prince. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, great talent. And the sound just sucked. In fact, sucked that bad, I actually had to be held back because it's not the right thing to do. I wanted to go up to the sound guy and say, like, do you want to get me stopped for a wee minute because something's not right? And then somebody said, no, he just sacks his sound man every 3 or 4 days.
Every 3 or 4 days, aye.
So, you know, it's just chaos, but it was terrible. Then I went to see The Who a week later, and it was quite great because it started okay, and I could hear the sound guy battling to get it to sound good, and he got it good, but, you know, it took half an hour, and he got it good.
I know the guy. He's a mate of mine. I know the guy.
Right. So, you know, it was like, brilliant, kudos. Charlie and I went to see, and I mean, I had to haul Charlie back. So we went to see Kate Bush. Kate Bush sort of came out of retirement.
Right.
Again, it was about 5 years ago, six. Couldn't get tickets for love nor money. And promoters, the guy we worked with, got us a great, and we got down. And Charlie and I were yards from the guitar player. And this was like, they did about 20 nights, so this was about the fourth night. So, you know, they've been around it. They know what they're doing. You cannot hear any of the guitar. And Charlie's going to me, I can't deal with this. I need to go up and tell him and stuff. And I'm saying, nah, it's, you know, it's nothing to do with us. And he's like, you can't hear the guitar. You can't hear it. Can you hear anything? And I said, no. And he said, right, let's go up and tell them. And because, you know, you need to tell them. And I was like, yeah, forget it. But that just shows you know, because when we go to gigs, we're fans. You know, we're in there. We want to hear the songs. You know, we toured, we've played a few times with Rolling Stones. We go in the crowd right down the front. We want to hear it. Keith Richards starts. It sounds like Zen Masters. It's just incredible. It's Keith Richard. Aye. There he is. And you're like, we got it. And there's kind of, unlike back in the day when we worked with you, and you'll know this and you'll probably explain it in your shows much more than I ever could, technology's come a long, long way, which enables you to be more consistent.
Aye.
Now.
Aye, in some regards, definitely the consistency's there. My pet peeve with the whole digital realm is just because you've got all the bells and whistles on the console that you never had before, doesn't mean you have to use them. So if it isn't a fucking song, then all the signal processing in the fucking world won't make any difference.
No, it doesn't. If you go and you hear, she came from planet Claire, you're like, I'm there.
Right, exactly.
The song's amazing. And they're giving 100%.
Aye, they still do.
And they're giving 100%. The band is great. You've got it down. That's it. You know, that's what we came for. That's what people try. I mean, people know, you know, think what's at stake. Apart from that, you know, I was saying, when people buy a ticket, see you, especially bands of a vintage. It's not just the financial that they've put over. They've invested their time, they've invested their emotion, they've been looking forward to it for months. This is my band. B-52 Civil Minds, oh, it's going to be great. They brought their pal for work, you'll love this. And you know, and they're so hyped up, they've invested so much in it. And if you go on and it sucks because it doesn't sound very good, or the band are a bit tired, or they're hoarding something in the tank for playing New York the next night or something, it's not on.
No. And there's no excuse these days with the gear, because, you know, I work with bands that don't have a budget, you know. I mean, I get what I need, but, the Bees are a very careful band. They do all right, but I have never had an unlimited budget. It's always highly scrutinised for what I can spend on gear and bringing gear in. So I'm modestly, but I care.
Sometimes if people gaggle to me, it was good, but it was awful loud. And you go, really? No, I don't like that. I say, where were you sitting? Right in front of the PA.
I know.
I said, well, you know, it'll be kind of loud there.
I've got some stock answers that they come up to me and they say I can't hear the vocals. I said, where are you sitting? They said, up at the back of the balcony there. I said, you should be, I bought a seat down here, it sounds great down here.
There's a gig I remember, there's many I remember you, but I was thinking today, in case you asked me to pull one out
for me.
Okay, you remember the venue, I can't remember the name, but we opened, well, we went on first, I think it was three bands that night, but I think it was New Order's first gig in the States, and it was in San Francisco.
Oh, in San Francisco at the Market Street Cinema.
You got it, right. So I was a big fan of Joy Division. I was enthusiastic to see what this New Order was going to be. I was looking forward to it. Anyway, we went on and we'd done our thing. And I remember you going mental that night because the equipment had been particularly crap.
But
we went down a storm. We went down really great and we were happy with that. But I remember you, we can't repeat the language that you were using. I think I could hear you from the stage screaming at people. But because you were passionate and you wanted to win, and we did win. Aye. Anyway, that was great. And the thing I remember was, so I went in the crowd to watch New Order because this was a big deal. And I remember it being the singularly worst sound I'd ever heard of anybody in my life. And I thought, well, you know, they'll get it together after two or three songs, whatever, but I don't know. It was,
I remember it got worse.
It got worse. It started tragic and it got worse. And the only thing that sounded good, we were laughing, was the drum machine. The drum machine sounded amazing. But the band were awful. Just as a footnote to that, and I'm sure it's an innocent mistake. It better be. Because the bass player, Hook, he's written a few books, and he talks about that night. And for some reason, he went into this thing of there was a bit of aggro between New Order and Simple Minds, and they came after us, and we were hiding in the dressing room. I thought, what are you on about? And Derek Forbes would have taken your head off. So the guys got confused, but every time I see him, I hope I see him because I'm going to pull him up. But what a lot of nonsense! But the singularly worst sound I'd ever, presumably, they got it better the next night or whatever. But it was a farce, and I thought, thank God,
we won.
Thank God we've got a great sound guy, and that's what's at stake.
Well, there was the Battle of the Boulevard Voltaire as well, where me and John Ramsey went at it. He was working for the Alarm, and I was mixing the silencers. And there was, I wasn't really getting, I wasn't really getting the full PA, if you can what I mean.
Oh, and that stuff, yeah.
Joe Donnelly had to pull me off. I was trying to crawl up Ramsey's belly to put the nut in him, and I couldn't get near him because his belly was that big.
Well,
and Joe Donnelly pulled me off and walked me down the boulevard Voltaire and said, come on, Gallagher, what is good? But, you know, stuff like that I care. And I also, to be fair, that was towards the end of my, shall we say, my partaking in substances as well, which thankfully...
Which led me to give you the name Caligula.
Caligula. Now, see, I was thinking about just calling this fucking... calling this whole thing Caligula, you know.
Yeah. I think I even called you at one point Frank Bacchanalia. No, Frank Gallagher.
Frank Bacchanalia.
Somebody said it's the Italian. I said, only in spirit. But
Forza, Forza Caligula.
You needed your sound man fighting for you because
I had to fight every day back then. Yeah, people, a lot of bands don't know. I mean, the Bees, I don't have to fight so hard, but they don't know what I have to do.
No, in general, things are a lot more tighter now with contracts and stuff.
Exactly.
People have to live up to, you know, and it doesn't, your promoters are much more sophisticated. It doesn't do their lives are they made easier if the sound sucks either, because people
complaining.
But as I said, you know, people say, well, you know, sound, how was the sound? I mean, would you go to the cinema and sit through a blurred screen? I mean, you would just go like, I want my money back. Stop it. So there you go. What you're saying there, I mean, we're the same. Every gig, I've got this, I quite like it, especially with the newer musicians that come in with us. I mean, we still, people that played with us for more than a decade are still the new guy or whatever.
Aye.
But, at a certain point, I'll say, you know, people get a bit nervous and you have to sort of steady the ship. And I'll say, listen. And it's true, because all the hard work is done up front. You do all the rehearsals. You've got the songs. It's going to be great. But I would say, listen, this is a piece of cake. This is a piece of cake. The only thing we have to do is be absolutely brilliant every single night. Because, and they go, wow. And I say, that's right. And whether you're playing 500 people, I mean, I think a great band, a great artist, you should be able to play a bar mitzvah and be able to play a stadium the next night. If you're great, if you've got greatness, and you'll find your way. Of course, there's different, you know, there's different tricks and there's different attitudes and there's different production if you want to do it. But essentially, what is coming out, the speakers, and certainly I can say from a performer, when you're in the heart of the song, you can be, whether you're playing to 10 people or 10,000 people, it doesn't matter. You're in that place.
Aye.
That's, you know, the place where all the good stuff emanates from.
That's fabulous. Well, the last fellow I talked to said to me, he said, Frank, do you ever give the band pointers? Do you ever give them notes? And I say, absolutely. Uh-huh. Any sound man at Disney, give the band and let them know, A, if it's working, especially with new material that they're bringing in or a new song. And I told him, I was there for when some of the songs were written with that last band. I was in the room, so the text of the song was easy for me. But just somebody handed me the album and saying, this is the new album, and that I wasn't involved in. I was away doing something else, and I wasn't involved in the recording. Mm. And then I would have to learn in the textures, and it still happens with it.
Yes.
If they're bringing it in. And he said, did you ever give them notes? I said, fucking right I did. I'd let them know if it was crap. Yeah. I'd let them know if it wasn't working. That's my job. And it wasn't. And then sometimes it would take me 4 or 5 shows to get the song sitting where I wanted it to sit, mix-wise and texture-wise, because I'm still learning it, picking out wee bits. So I think it's crucial that any band that employs a sound man listens to them.
Well,
you know, a lot of them don't.
Well, you need somebody in there. We had a tour manager at a point. It was after you, a guy called Stan Tippins, who you'll know.
Oh, I know Stan, aye.
Stan was very, you know, he'd give you a mark out of 5 every night. And he had his little diary and all that. And he, you know, and he was usually right. You know, you could argue with him, but he was usually right. He would. Yeah, I don't think the energy was there or whatever. But it's funny. We do so much of the work up front, and
aye.
Because I'm not a musician, I can stand, you know, for the first few weeks, it's all about the music. And then when we've got that done and the arrangements done, the vocals, me and Sarah go in and all that. So by that time, so I'm on the sidelines looking in, and I'll direct stuff. And we kind of work it all out. But what I'll do is pretty, you know, I'll know before we get into the rehearsal, kind of the rough plan. But once we're in there, we'll say, right, this is what we're going to do. Once we've got that done, we'll go like, right, anyone get any ideas, anything we're missing here on this, anything that we're not getting right, or anything that's not shaping up? And, you know, people will say, sound man will say, monitor guy will say, is that thing, you know, that might work on the record, but it's getting in the way here. So right. We kind of have the two of them going, what's it going to be? You know, so there's people are encouraged. People are encouraged to give opinions and say what's what. Because at the end of the day, they're all there. I mean, the people that work with us, and you were saying, they're so committed. I mean, you look, our band, I mean, they always were. But back in the early days, it was rough and ready. There was a lot more drinking. There was a lot more partying. There was a lot more whatever. Now, you know, these young team, you know, they're like college graduates. You know, they come in with their...
Strictly business. Strictly business.
They come in with their work done. They don't like any flakery. They don't, you know, what are we doing? Have you told us? Have you got it mapped out? Give me it. You know, it's great. I mean, they really are. They're, and some of the people they work with, three, four, when I worked with this band, it was all done. I knew what I was doing, you know. You know, you have to leave a certain looseness to see what happens. But in general, people like a map. But I used to, there was a period where I didn't go to sound checks because basically, between singing, you know, half a dozen songs at the sound check, and then you're talking to people down there for half an hour and all that. If you're doing four or five gigs a week, you know, that's like an extra gig. And over a tour. So for a period, I didn't go to sound check. So it was like that. But I do now. And even if I don't sing, I'll get them to run things, and there'll be things that I think, you know, I'll talk to the sound guy, say, I've got a feeling something's, why is that not, that bridge, why is, that should be, stuff should be ascending there. You should feel the track going up. Why is this not what, and we'll go through things, and we'll analyse things, and so I guess that's like notes or homework or whatever you want to call it.
That's brilliant. So
I'm all talking to Gallagher.
We're going to wrap it up there, and I want to thank you very much for doing this. And I'm on the brew at the moment, so if you've got a job for me, I'll sign off.
Well, I'm on the brews. if you need anybody that's a dodgy dancer and sings flat, I'm your guy.
I promise you a mackerel.
All right,
my son.
Great talking to you.
Great. Bye. Thanks very much.
Toodle-pip. Bye-bye.
Ta-ra. Thanks very much for plugging in. We can't do it without you. And don't forget to check out our website, soundmanconfidential.com, for news and my upcoming shows and all the fabulous guests you're going to have the pleasure of listening to. Catch you next time. Soundman Confidential is produced by Alan Black, with our team, Chip Bentley on sound production, web design Addie Bell, original music Paul Westwater, and public relations, Paddy DeVries at Devious Planet Media.